Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of The Europeans. It's just a normal episode.
Everything's fine.
Nothing's happened.
Do you know what, though? In these very weird times, it is quite nice to take comfort in the fact that they may have closed the borders, we may not be allowed to go outside, but you and me are still here, crouched on the floor with our microphones in really uncomfortable positions. Like, some things haven't changed.
It's very true, and I'm hoping we'll be able to continue podcasting all the way through this crisis, however long it may last.
Where do you think people are listening to this? Because normally people listen on the train or the bus to work. So I wonder if people are like doing laps of their apartments, like pretending that they're commuting.
If it's anything like my life, then they're probably running up and down the stairs, hoovering. We spent like 2 days hoovering and we've got a really tiny flat. So our flat has no dust in it at all. I also have no work other than the podcast coming up for the next 6 months. So that's fun.
These are like weird and sad times. But I have to say there's plenty of things on the internet that have been cheering me up. Like lockdown is really bringing out the creativity in Europeans. There are videos of people doing some hilarious things. Did you see the two guys playing tennis between the windows of two apartments next door to each other?
No, but that sounds very dangerous with broken glass.
And my other favourite is the guy in Spain pretending that the gas rings on his cooker are like DJ decks. And he's like going wild and having a little party all to himself.
That also sounds very wasteful and dangerous.
Jeez, negative Nancy. Lockdown is bringing out the worst in you.
Oh, it is. I'm sorry. But actually, we asked our listeners this week to share some stories with us, some positive stories or moments of unexpected kindness. And we got some really nice responses.
Hi, Europeans podcast.
I live in Berlin and manage an orchestra called Le Concert Olympique.
I own a little small business, house cleaning business, and people chip in, paying just a little bit extra or paying altogether and not having the cleaning, which is amazing. And
one of our older musicians, who's actually a freelancer herself, immediately insisted on donating her salary to the younger musicians who are inevitably going to struggle over the coming months and possibly beyond.
I live on a boat in a marina, and my good news story is that our marina office has promised to deliver any food or post directly to our boats for any of us who are self-isolating.
People are good, and everything's going to be fine. We will survive this one.
I wrote some letters to local nursing home residents. So that's one small piece of kindness that's come out of this that I may not have normally done on a normal busy week. Anyway, sending you solidarity, it's somewhat weirdly comforting to know that we're all kind of going through the same feelings and strangeness at the same time.
I love what Britta is doing. That is such a lovely thing to do. Before I left Paris, I set up a WhatsApp group for my building to make sure that we were like looking after any old people that live there. And I was kind of congratulating myself for this gesture and thinking like, what a nice thing I'd done. But then when I asked like, what about that old lady on the third floor? Is she okay? People were just like, oh, she left, but what a piece of work she was. And it just like descended into people reminiscing about how horrible this neighbor had been, which was really not what I intended, but it was very funny.
There are also a few people who sent us messages without their voices, which were also gratefully received. For example, Mr. Logan33 on Instagram, who wrote to tell us about the really nice moment in Spain when the whole country went out onto their balconies to cheer and applaud the healthcare workers who were facing the virus. And he said that he got very emotional, partly because it's so rare when everyone agrees on one thing in Spain.
People have been really rising to the challenge and sending us loads of nice things, like pictures of their dogs and like funny videos of Italian healthcare workers pretending that they're in Ghostbusters.
And stories of neighbours dropping off some extra parsley at people's front door.
Parsley?
Parsley. Everyone needs parsley. That was Victoria.
I would be very ungrateful for that.
Don't be such a parsley snob. But also finally, I wanted to give a shout out to a new Twitter account from Sandra Cavallo, who works at the European Commission's Communications Department. And she set up a new account called @positive_COVID. And she shares positive stories from this awful crisis. There was one that stood out for me, and it was actually a tweet from America. Is that okay?
I suppose so.
So it read, Friends cancelled their son's bar mitzvah this weekend, but decided to keep the contract with their caterer, a Tiny Hmong-owned business. They delivered the food to friends in quarantine and sent pans home with others. So that's one of the many nice stories that emerges on her Twitter account. So follow it if you can.
Who are we talking to this week?
Well, we are sticking with the broad concept that there are plenty of other things to talk about besides coronavirus. And I hope that this next half hour will serve as a distraction whilst we talk about all the other depressing things that are happening on the continent of Europe. Actually, that's not true. It's not going to be such a depressing episode. And as you'll discover, we've got a slightly tweaked Good Week, Bad Week segment coming up. But we're then going to be making a call to someone very special in Denmark. Emma Holten. She made international headlines some years ago for her original and brave response to an online leak of some naked pictures she'd taken of herself for her boyfriend when she was 17. We'll talk about what that response was later in the show. It may sound like it's going to be depressing, but Emma is totally inspiring and we really enjoyed speaking to her earlier in the week. So I hope you enjoy it too.
But first, extraordinary times call for extraordinary measures. So in place of our usual Good Week, Bad Week segment, here's Good Week, Good Week.
Good Week!
Who's had a good week, Dominic?
We are giving Good Week to King Felipe VI of Spain for making a very important decision. The British royal family may have been going through a few things the past year, but they are not the only European monarchy with pretty serious skeletons emerging in their closets. Remember Juan Carlos? He was the King of Spain from 1975 till 2014, when he abdicated due to a number of scandals. But the abdication and handover of the crown to his son Felipe didn't put an end to the scandals circling Juan Carlos. The most recent allegation that he's facing came from the Daily Telegraph, who claim that a foundation set up by Juan Carlos, the Locum Foundation, which has its home in an offshore bank account, contains around 65 million euros, which were described as having been a donation from the King of Saudi Arabia.
A donation?
A donation!
Is it like an animal shelter now? Like, what's it for?
Yeah, well, that's the thing we're not sure about. And it's also on top of another offshore account that he's been connected to, which is actually under investigation by Swiss investigators. So it's all rather suspicious and was causing quite a lot of trouble for the current King of Spain, King Felipe VI. The reason why this story became a Good Week story was because King Felipe did the right thing and decided to renounce the personal inheritance he was due to get from his father. Now, he's the King of Spain. He probably doesn't need it, I thought. But let's look at that. How much wealth does King Felipe have? According to Business Insider, his net worth is about 16 million euros. He also gets a yearly salary of around 240,000 euros, which he, to be fair to him, voluntarily cut by 20% a few years ago. But despite that 20% cut, he's definitely still doing okay. And he also has 8 palaces, 5 country homes and 10 monasteries or convents. So it might not be hugely life-changing for him to not receive all those many millions from his father's offshore accounts after he dies. But I imagine the family implications from a decision like that are pretty significant. And not only did he renounce his inheritance, he also decided to remove his father's stipend. Up until now, Juan Carlos had been receiving a yearly stipend of around 194,000 euros.
Not bad.
So a bit less than his son, but I'd take just a few of them right now, to be honest.
I'd like one of these palaces to self-isolate in.
Okay, we'll ask.
Thank you.
But I still think King Felipe VI of Spain deserves Good Week for doing the right thing and distancing himself from his father's rather suspicious behaviour. Juan Carlos himself is protected by the constitution from the Spanish courts, but he could find himself in legal trouble abroad. And there are actually calls within the country from the left-wing Podemos party, who are in coalition government at the moment, to open an investigation into Juan Carlos's actions. Juan Carlos has a checkered history. His abdication in 2014 was preceded by a particularly controversial elephant hunting trip in Botswana.
Oh, God.
Yeah. and also corruption allegations involving his daughter, Christina. But he was hailed by some for his role in Spain's transition to democracy following the death of Franco. But luckily for him, any investigation in the Spanish Parliament is unlikely to happen anytime soon for perhaps obvious reasons. So he may get a bit of a reprieve. But for now, good week for his son, Felipe, who, yeah, as I said before, I think he did the right thing.
I think he did too. And also thanks for giving us a bit of royal drama to take our minds off things. Do you remember Harry and Meghan? That feels like a really long time ago.
Yeah, and Prince Andrew even longer ago.
Ancient history.
Who else has had a good week, Katie?
It has also been a good week for Greece's first ever female president, who has just taken office. Congratulations to Ekaterina Sakellaropoulou. Greek politics is not the easiest place to be a woman. There's only 5 women in the cabinet out of 52 people.
5 out of 52?
Yeah, it's not great.
That's really quite bad.
And Sakellaropoulou is the first woman in the 200 years that Greece has been an independent country to be its president. And actually, it's quite a big deal that she's been appointed because Greece has a right-wing prime minister right now. And that prime minister did, however, decide to appoint a progressive judge to be the head of state, which is unusual and quite a nice act of bipartisanship for once, which I think we should celebrate. The prime minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, has also quite a bad record of just like not appointing any women as per his cabinet. So it's quite nice to see a woman like given this job, even if it is mostly a ceremonial role.
Why did this happen?
Well, I think one of the reasons he appointed her is that even though she has like really progressive views, she isn't a party politician. And Greece has obviously been having like a really tough time in recent years. They're trying to climb out of an economic crisis. And there is this ongoing terrible situation for refugees in Greece. So it's good to have a leader who can like symbolize a break with the past in a way that isn't like party political.
Mm-hmm.
What can I tell you about her? Well, she is a judge. She used to be the head of Greece's top court. And she's a pretty massive civil rights defender. She's been really vocal on the need to stop gender discrimination, speaking up for civil partnerships for same-sex couples, better rights for refugee children, better environmental protection. So she runs like really quite counter to the current of opinion in the ruling party. And there are going to be lots of people in the government who are not happy with this woman being appointed. So fair play to the prime minister for doing this.
Yeah, this is the week for giving good week to white men who have done good things that they obviously should have done anyway.
We're not giving good week to the prime minister, we're giving it to the president. I think she's had a very good week, even if her inauguration was a bit weird. There was nobody there, basically, because of the C word. But it is a nice moment again of consensus. There's been quite a few of them this week, it seems, despite all the weird stuff that's going on. So that's kind of cool. Nice one, Greece.
I like good week, good week.
I like it too. Maybe we should do this every week. We have some new people to thank for supporting us on Patreon, who are Marco Perulli and Amy Campbell-Bogie. Thank you guys so much.
Yeah, thank you. Particularly in these weird times, it's really nice that you are doing this. And I hope it's because you've got fixed employment and can afford to do it.
The Patreon group is also one of my favourite places to hang out at the moment, because there is a constant stream of people posting like nice, supportive things.
Yeah, the internet is actually a really nice place some of the time, but sometimes it's a totally awful place. And someone who knows that more than most people is our next guest, Emma Holton. One night in 2011, she was violated online. Her accounts were hacked by someone and strangers ended up poking around in all her files and messages online and found some photos of her naked that she'd sent to her boyfriend at the time. Since then, almost 10 years have passed and Emma has become a champion against online violation and has spearheaded the campaign for consent, both online and in real life. We were thrilled that Emma was willing to speak to us a few days ago, and we hope you are as inspired by her story as we were.
Can we go back to that moment in 2011 when you realised that your emails and your online accounts had been hacked and pictures of you had been put on the internet without your permission? What on earth does that feel like?
With bad things that can happen to people, we have a narrative for it. Like if a person is robbed or they get ill, like there's a narrative and you think, okay, there's a way I'm supposed to react, or this is something that people will understand. But I think because the crime that happened to me was so new, I'd never heard about irregular people being sexually violated on the internet. I'd heard about, you know, Paris Hilton and Kim Kardashian, but I had no way of reacting. So I think I was just like profoundly confused, like not understanding what's the consequences of this, who knows this, how long will this last? But I think the extreme sense of violation was very early on clear to me that I had been violated by people, and that my privacy and my body and my person had been hugely disrespected and disregarded by huge amounts of people.
And was there any obvious, clear course of like legal action that you, or criminal action that you could take reporting it at that time?
Not at all. I didn't even know if this was illegal. I think the first couple of days, I just tried to go kind of a humane route and kind of contacting the sites where the pictures were and saying, you know, these are here without my consent and please remove them. And very few places responded that they wanted to remove them. But the most predominant response was, you know, prove that this is without your consent. You know, maybe you're just regretting it. Or, you know, even in the worst reaction, you know, we don't give a fuck about what you feel. You can't do anything. And then a couple of days after it happened, I contacted the police here in Denmark and said, you know, this has happened. And then they asked me to send them the links to where the pictures were. And while they looked at the pictures, they told me, these aren't that bad. And I said, well, I think so. And then they told me, sure, we're pretty sure that this is illegal in Denmark, but if we were you, we wouldn't waste our time. We're not going to do anything, so.
The men who were commenting on these pictures on the sites that they were put on, and these were all kinds of men, like young boys and dads and older men.
Yeah, yeah.
From the comments, it was clear that the fact that they were non-consensual pictures was like part of the thrill for them. What did you make of that at the time?
I was very confused by it. I was like, you know, there are so many naked women on the internet who want to be there and who are getting paid to be there and who have it as their, you know, job. Why would you seek out someone who doesn't want to be there? And it really increased my sense of discomfort and pain to understand that violating a person in this way was a part of the excitement for a lot of people. I was 20 years old and was not a feminist. And this was, you know, also a different time. Our discussions about gender and sexual violations was not at the point where it is now. I did not understand that this was related to misogyny or, you know, toxic masculinity and these names we have for these things now. But I very clearly understood that this was about power from very early on, that I had lost some power over myself and these people had taken power over me. And this took like very concrete shapes. You know, they were harassing me, contacting my employer, my friends, sharing it around, pictures with my address, with my phone number. Something that's very underreported is how blackmail is also a big part of this crime. Attempted blackmail was a constant part of my life. You know, send me more naked pictures or I'll send this to your mother. Send me $1,000 or I'll send this to, you know, your entire Facebook friends list. That is a constant part of your life. So it ends up becoming an extreme paranoia that there are people out there who want to hurt you all the time.
So one of the ways in which you, I think, tried to take that power back was you made a decision in 2014 to collaborate with a photographer and consensually release some photos of yourself into the world. How did you come up with this idea and was it cathartic?
This was not something that came around quickly. It wasn't like, oh, this happened, I'm going to do this as a response. It took me 3 years to get to a point where I thought something here is happening and I can't live like this. The Consent Project, as it was called, came out of the fact that I was very frustrated by the conversations that were being had around the crime that had happened to me, because people were only talking about the victims. You know, why did we do what we did? Is it true that, you know, the women who this happened to are much more sexual and much more stupid than other women? And no one was talking about the fact that this was hugely revealing about power dynamics and gender dynamics in our society and how we look at young women and our sexuality. And it was very important to me to very clearly signal that I didn't think that I'd done anything wrong. I hadn't hurt anybody. I hadn't committed any crime. I hadn't done anything to purposely, you know, ruin anybody's lives. but other people had done that to me. And no one was talking about who they were and what they, why they were doing what they were doing. So the Consent Project was a way of standing by myself as a young woman who had a sexuality, and to kind of show that what had destroyed me was not the fact that people had seen me naked. What had really destroyed me was the fact that I hadn't gotten the right to choose when that happened. And in a way, the project was a relief or a catharsis to me, because I realized that I was right, that there actually is a difference between being seen naked with and without consent. It's kind of like the difference between being force-fed and eating at a restaurant. I think most people will know the difference.
Well, they're a really, really beautiful set of photos, and they were shared super widely.
Yeah.
Was it daunting to become a feminist role model?
I thought, honestly, that 10 Danish feminists would see this and be like, oh, that's interesting, great concept, you know, good for her. And then, you know, a month after the project, I was on a plane to London to film a video for The Guardian that ended up being viewed, like, I think 3 million times. Everything was just turned upside down. I was completely in shock. But in a way, I had spent these 3 years kind of educating myself and becoming a feminist and thinking a lot about what this said about Danish society, the European society at large, our relationship to young women. So when people, when I did do interviews, even though I was young, I was ready to answer them.
So things have changed since 2011. There are some stronger legal protections for victims of these kind of violation across much of Europe. And there's also like more of an understanding of the problem because of people like you talking out. Do you think there is enough legal protection, or do you still think that there are changes that you see across Europe that need to be made?
I think what's difficult is that so much of what has happened to me legally is completely untread ground. So, for example, in Denmark, this has always been illegal. Denmark is pretty unique in this regard, because sharing pictures of a person that you can rightly assume that person want private has been illegal in Denmark always. That is not the case everywhere, but it's coming the case in more and more places. However, with stuff like this, it's always kind of a knife's edge walk between freedom of speech and protecting individuals. So, for example, in Europe, we have this EU law called the right to be forgotten, which is a law that makes it possible for you to have a result moved from a Google search that is not deemed to be relevant anymore. The fact that these pictures are not the first thing that come up when you Google me increases my quality of life immensely. However, there are also examples of this law being used to, you know, protect people who are using it to remove information that maybe is relevant to the public. So when protecting people like me, we're constantly having this incredibly complex conversation of who gets to decide what is relevant to the public. So, for example, with the right to be forgotten law, when you apply to have something removed, it's not a policeman or a judge that decides it. It's someone who's employed at Google who decides. I think in many European countries, actually, we're legally protected all right. However, what is not happening is these big platforms are not being held to account in strong enough ways. Most laws in Europe are still nationally grounded. So, for example, if someone violates me on Facebook, but they're in Italy or Spain, they won't be held to account by Danish law in the same way. And I think actually that's our big issue.
I saw your really passionate speech in front of the TNW conference that you did a few years ago. And in it, you appealed to them to work with you and to think about the humans that are negatively affected by their inventions and the violence that can be done using their platforms. How did they respond to that? Did anyone actually take you up on your offer to work together, and has anything changed since then?
Well, I haven't heard a lot, interestingly enough. I think Facebook do want to do something. I find people at Facebook, when I meet them, they do invite me to workshops and stuff. But they are in a pinch, because their entire business model is people being able to upload things incredibly fast without having it screened first. And what I'm talking about is saying, you know, not only are people uploading, you know, all these fake news and harassment, but they're also uploading, you know, concretely illegal material like what happened to me. What's difficult with these platforms is that we let them get so big before we had this conversation, that now when they have to implement, you know, measures that protect people like me, it's always an afterthought.
Beyond the law and beyond the way that we regulate the internet, we have been talking a lot more as a society, I think, about consent over the last few years, particularly because of the Me Too movement.
Yeah, for sure.
Do you think that will bring lasting change?
I do. I am an optimist. I think sometimes in the feminist movement, we can get so exhausted and tired from what we experience that we sometimes forget the things that have changed. When I look back at me creating the Consent Project in 2014, you know, talking about sexual violations and what a sexual violation is was just not something that people talked about ever. And I think when you look at a person like Harvey Weinstein, who was convicted the other day, got 23 years in prison, he had been harassing women for decades, famous women, rich women, in terrible ways for decades. And it had just happened because we had no language for talking about this way of using sex and power together to silence victims and make victims feel ashamed and make victims blame themselves. And I think we have a completely different language for that now. That's not to say that this will stop happening. Like, I think sexual consent violations is still, you know, everywhere. But just the fact that consent is a word that people actually, you know, use, even that in itself is new. But I think we're starting slowly to understand that consent violations of people is a profound way to disregard their humanity, a way to make them feel like they are nothing. And we didn't understand that before. But I think we're getting there. Also, the last thing that's incredibly important is that us who live with this every day, we don't feel so alone. And that is, I think, the first step to coming to as a society, is to make people who are victims feel that they can speak about what's happened to them because they're not the only ones.
Thank you so much to Emma for joining us this week. You can and should follow her on all of the social medias. We will post links in the show notes. After we ended the interview, we were talking about the thing that we all can't stop talking about. And we were exchanging some recommendations for things to like watch and read. Emma's recommendation for a great book to get stuck into right now is Severance by Ling Ma, which is, what is it, Dominic?
She said it was a kind of feminist epidemic story from New York.
Sounds excellent. I'm going to get straight into that one as soon as I finish my current plague-themed novel.
I am going to recommend something that's totally non-plague-themed that I recommended to Katie earlier in the week when she was wanting some distraction, because actually that's what I want currently is distraction. And I've been really enjoying Call My Agent on Netflix, which is a really silly comedy drama about an actor's agency in France. And you enjoyed it, didn't you?
I love it. It's quite trashy, but it's what we need right now.
If you've got any other good, distracting, potentially trashy things to watch, listen, or read, then let us know and maybe we'll start shouting them out as a regular, semi-regular thing. This week's happy ending comes from the country that I reside in, the Netherlands, where news broke this week that some dogs have done a really good job at protecting some sheep. It was a 2-year trial in the Dutch province of Overijssel, and it was looking into a way of protecting livestock from wolves. In this trial, it was some very lovely Pyrenean mountain dogs, some Hungarian kuvashes, and Turkish akbash dogs who were protecting the friendly little sheep from the growing wolf population of the Netherlands.
Oh, there were wolves in the Netherlands, because it's a quite big thing in like the French mountains, but...
Katie, don't you remember we did an episode about this like back in February 2018? Yes, we talked about the fact that there were wolves appearing in the Netherlands.
Oh.
Anyway, if you've forgotten that, then you, like Katie, should go back and check out that episode, which was called Making Peace with Wolves, and also features one of our favourite ever interviews with the Greek-Swedish journalist Alexander Pascalidou. But I thought this was a good happy ending because I love animals helping each other out. What happier story is there? even if the animals being trained to help each other out for the sake of the human farmers. But
I was going to say, save them so that we can eat them.
But hey, it's happy news, and it's a good sign that there are ways for us to cohabit with wolves once again, now that they are re-emerging in many parts of the continent after a long time away in many of these countries. And that is actually a really exciting thing for this once quite endangered species. The two-year project successfully demonstrated that dogs can protect livestock from attacks from both wolves and other dogs. Over the 2 years, there was not a single attack on the livestock. The European Wilderness Society are actually also trying to launch a big five-year trial in the Alps that will continue to develop these strategies for protecting livestock. So congrats to the team of Bay 12 and their partners for completing this two-year trial with happy results. Happy sheep equal happy humans. It's as simple as that, isn't it?
Happy sheep until we eat them.
I don't eat sheep.
Good for you. Instead of doing any work, I'm mostly tweeting cheerful videos from our Twitter account. So you should come and hang out there if cheerful videos are your bag, at Europeans Pod.
You can also come and hang out with us on Instagram at Europeans Podcast. Or send us an email, hello@europeanspodcast.com. We want to keep collecting any positive stories you have, so send them our way.
We will be back next week, as always, because, like I said, we have nowhere else to go. Look after yourselves and your loved ones in the meantime, everyone.
Yeah, and if that means not seeing them, then so be it.
Dominic really hates it when I say take care, because he thinks it's patronising or something.
Take care, yeah, I don't know.
Take care.
In these days, it's really appropriate, but I sometimes think it sounds a bit like, be careful.
I think we should be careful.
Okay, it's come into its own. Take care, everyone.
Bye.